thanks everyone for coming to taking place. This term we've been looking at the theme of landscape and heritage, and we've had two talks. The first one was on indigenous population and trying to preserve some sort of identity through cartography, and the second talk was on language and landscape in Greenland. And today we're going to look more at an ecocentric approach. We have Brian Eversham, who's the chief executive of the Wildlife Trust for Cambridgeshire, Bedfordshire, Peterborough, and Camborne.
Northamptonshire,
sorry. He's going to talk about conservation, and the title of his talk is From Preserving Sites to Restoring Nature.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for being here. This is probably going to be the most diverse audience I've talked to for a while, from what I heard before I got here. What I want to do in the next 50 or 60 minutes is basically to talk you through the origins and the development of nature conservation in the UK. But whenever I get the chance to take a much longer timescale perspective on conservation and where we come from. So the gist of it is to start with the origin of conservation in the 19th century, take quite a wide detour into how wildlife itself has changed over the last century and the factors affecting it, which really gives us the context and motive force behind the conservation movement, to talk a bit about legislation for wildlife conservation, which also is one of the driving forces behind people's attitude toward it, and then to finish off with the current and future responses to the biggest factors affecting wildlife, of which climate change, I would say, was number one. First thing to say is that people have been aware of and had a fairly detailed understanding of wildlife, its natural history and behaviour for a very, very long time. But for most of that time, the two foci of people's understanding of wildlife has been what can we eat and what might eat us. And looking at wildlife for other less utilitarian purposes is a relatively recent phenomenon. We can go back 3,000 or 4,000 years and find fairly clear evidence of people having a fairly precise understanding of individual plant and animal species. Indeed, the species concept was pretty well established in Egypt, in Greece and in Rome, and a lot of Aristotle's writings, in part at least, tally with modern concepts. It's not been a linear process of development of understanding. The medieval period, particularly in Western Europe, seems to have gone off in some fairly strange tangents, and the blurring of the boundary between ecology and natural history, mythology and Chinese whispers is actually really quite entertaining to follow through. So we find Egyptian hieroglyphs, Greek and Roman mosaics being far more accurate in their depiction of non-European species than much of the stuff we get in the medieval period. But it was Victorians, I think, who actually embody the cataloguing, the understanding, the collecting of natural objects at its most extreme, together with some development in human understanding. And it may have been actually the extent of the Victorian collecting mania that actually prompted the notion, which I think for most cultures probably was about the first, that wildlife and the environment needed conservation and protection. In most other cultures, the assumption was that nature was in some ways limitless, it was there to be exploited. The Victorians started discovering they were having an impact. Plant species became extinct in the 19th century through, for instance, the Victorian fern craze. In Cambridge, quite a number of species were collected to extinction between 1830 and 1890. So it was toward the end of the Victorian era that the first organisations were set up with conservation in mind. What became the RSPB, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, established in 1889, primarily to protect individual birds from slaughter as decoration for ladies' hats. The same organisation very quickly started focusing also on egg collecting, both for science or decoration, but also the commercial collecting of seabird eggs for the production of patent leather. It was one of the very first campaigns of the incipient RSPB. I put the Duchess of Portland up there because I think she's one of the forgotten individuals of the conservation movement. She probably had the longest impact. She was the first chairman of RSPB in 1891 and continued in that role until she died in the 1950s. I can think of no other individual who's had a national role for such an important and such a long period. 100 years ago this year, the foundation of what was at that time called the Society for the Promotion of Nature Reserves, started by Charles Rothschild, the Northamptonshire landowner, active in Cambridgeshire too, I see as being, in some ways, globally a turning point. Land had been acquired in the past for public recreation. The National Trust had been founded a decade or so earlier, and indeed Wicken Fen was established as a nature reserve, but very much as a one-off. And there's clear evidence the National Trust didn't quite know what to do with wild spaces. Rothschild and his colleagues recognised that acquiring land and managing land with wildlife in mind was actually the key to the way forward in conservation. As early as 1915, he produced a national shopping list of nature reserves. The questionnaire on the right-hand side is blessedly short compared with most modern inventories of wildlife habitat. It's written in fairly plain English. Some of the terminology would have changed. We don't these days often talk about typical primeval country. But if you go for a walk in the Fens or in the upland moors or in parts of Scotland, you know what he means. The data capture was also interesting. He contacted local naturalists, everything from the sort of late Victorian clergy through to local societies and organisations, and basically said, what do you think is important and special about your area? The data capture varies from a scribble note on the back of a postcard to 100-page dossiers justifying a particular piece of land as being unusual, exceptional, classically important. And we have maps, we have the whole of this correspondence today. The motive behind it, in many ways, was actually to maintain the hunting ground of the amateur naturalist. Rothschild himself, in addition to being a world authority on fleas, was a passionate collector of butterflies and moths. The Fens of East Anglia were one of his favourite hunting grounds. He built a collector's home there, I suppose. It was built on the model of a Hungarian hunting lodge. And here, a few years after Rothschild's death, we have some of his friends and contacts at Walton Fen, with their collecting gear. The very fact that this was needed, though, was a reflection on Rothschild's awareness and that of his friends and colleagues that landscapes they'd known throughout their lives were ceasing to be there. The concept of landscape change, the drainage of the Fens in the 1850s, the loss of the last surviving fragments made conservation a powerful motive. At this point, I'll take that long detour for about 25 minutes, looking at how landscape and wildlife in Britain has changed over the last century, and the driving forces behind it, which have helped to shape both legislation and also people's attitudes to our countryside in this country. I've listed the five key factors, I think, from a UK perspective, in increasing order of importance. If this were a global talk, or if I were coming to you from Hawaii or Galapagos or any other oceanic islands, species introductions would be the key overriding factor. Humans having transported rats, mice, cats, dogs, goats around the planet have devastated many isolated ecosystems which have evolved completely in the absence of these highly competitive placental mammals. In this country, although we have problems with introduced species, I wouldn't rank them as being the really strong driving forces behind conservation. Himalayan balsam is one of an elite handful of botanical menaces which we brought to this country. Japanese knotweed, giant hogweed, some of the aquatic plants would be in the same category. But relatively few. And to put this in context, the standard British flora includes about 1,700 native species, around 3,000 introduced species, and of those 3,000, perhaps a dozen are serious invasive pests that are threatening native wildlife. So the vast majority of alien species slot in somewhere. If you walk around Cambridge City, you will see lots of plant species growing out of cracks in the pavement, cracks in the walls, plants that don't belong in Britain, that come from the Mediterranean, from South Africa, from Southeast Asia, from North America, thriving but not actually competing with the native flora. Likewise, among birds and mammals, a fair few introduced species have arrived here, mostly have settled into a niche. American mink is the one serious destroyer of wildlife, and even a mink has much more of an impact because of the nature of the modern landscape. The key victim of mink, I suppose, is the water vole, ratty from Wind in the Willows, which is extinct in many English counties these days, down to a handful of individuals in other areas, thriving in the Cambridge Fens, because here we still have a dense enough network of suitable habitat that mink are unable to sweep through the landscape and remove, kill, eat all the water voles. If you've got a single watercourse, take say the River Cam, there would have been abundant water voles on the Cam 50 years ago. Mink have eliminated them completely. In an area where you have a network of surviving habitat, the voles thrive, the mink may feed upon them, but are not able actually to wipe them out. So here we've got a case of an introduced species having a big impact, but only because the habitat itself has been so simplified and narrowed down. If I were giving a talk like this 30 or 40 years ago, then the key factors I would have been talking about as threats to biodiversity would have been acid rain and atmospheric pollution. Now in Britain in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, London smogs in particular were sufficiently severe they killed people. As soon as a problem kills people, politicians take it seriously. The very fact that over the previous 1,000 years our air had been sufficiently polluted to eliminate key sensitive species, these lichens dripping from trees in Tenerife, would have occurred throughout lowland Britain until sometime shortly after the Norman Conquest. There's strong evidence that the first stage of industrialisation in the 12th, 13th, 14th century eliminated some lichen species, some bog moss species, from places like industrial South Yorkshire, where we have a good record of biodiversity in the preserved in the peat bogs. The Clean Air Acts of the 60s and 70s have changed that process. We don't yet have metre-long lichens dripping from Cambridge city trees, but we do have pollution-sensitive lichens recolonising the area. This gorgeous yellowy-green beast is highly sensitive to sulphur dioxide. It can't grow in areas where mean winter sulphur dioxide levels are above about 50 parts per thousand. It was eliminated from an area across central England known to geographers as the industrial coffin. That gorgeous area stretching from Newcastle down to Bristol and widening out in the middle in order to encompass Cambridgeshire. Now this species is found on most clumps of willow trees and most ancient woodlands in our area, and each time I visit a local nature reserve I discover more lichen species coming back into an area that had the vast majority eliminated by what for humans was sublethal pollution. But you do wonder whether or not the much shorter human lifespan during most of that period was at least in part due to the quality of air we were breathing. And it's interesting that as in the 17th and 18th century, wealthy landowners often assessed their potential new estate by looking at the lichen cover on trees. The biology of lichens wasn't well understood, but they knew enough to recognise that an estate full of lichens on the trees was likely to be a good, healthy place to live. Moving on to the next serious threat changing the landscape for wildlife, urbanisation and development has been the single biggest dramatic change until the mid-20th century. Every new road, every new railway has carved the country up into smaller parcels of land within which wildlife may or may not survive. 19th century urbanisation eliminated the majority of wildlife species from certain key areas, but the countryside in between survived. Those living around Cambridge for any period will have noticed this is still an intensive ongoing process. Under the previous government, the three counties I cover had a house building target of 270,000 houses in the next 15 years. Now, the recession has completely derailed that, but the demand for new property is still there, and as soon as we get out of the present recession, we can expect that to be back with force. But in the last century, the biggest single factor, simplifying the countryside and removing biodiversity for most of it, has been intensification of agriculture. Now, this photograph is probably taken somewhere around 1890-1900, and two very striking things about it. One is the number of people. Farming was an extremely labour-intensive pursuit until the Second World War. And secondly, is either there was a very small people or that is very tall corn. Wheat and barley pre-war would usually be waist high to shoulder high. These days, if you walk through a local cornfield, you're looking at a crop about knee height. And just, 50 or 60 generations of crop breeding without GM crops has actually reduced the height of the corn because the stems were no longer needed either as straw or as thatch. The modern equivalent is a clean crop without weeds and one man in a large machine covering vast areas, spraying on most arable land probably two plant-killing pesticides, two herbicides, two or three fungicides, one or two insecticides every year, plus soil doused with artificial chemicals as fertiliser. The things about this picture which would strike our forefathers as odd, firstly, is the scale of the machine, secondly, the lack of horses, thirdly, the lack of people, and fourthly, the monoculture. The concept of a monoculture was just not possible until agrochemicals came onto the scene in the 1940s. I'm too young to have seen corncob growing wild in this country. The only place this plant grows nowadays in the UK is on arable weed reserves maintained on the edge of nature reserves, where it's planted deliberately. It's got a large heavy seed, which is relatively easy to remove from the gathered corn, so when you put your seed corn back, you can remove corncockle seeds. Poppies are still out there, but seldom do we these days see a whole field turning scarlet as it did do as recently as the 1970s and early 80s. So nowadays these are plants we associate with field margins, with road verges, with disturbed ground in towns, rather than across the whole of the crop landscape. And with those plants disappearing and their seeds disappearing, so go the bird species and the insect species dependent on them. But I put in this particular one for a different reason as well. This is the soil bunting. Seed-eating bird, closely related to yellowhammer, and now exceedingly scarce. And if you study British wildlife, you'll be familiar with maps of this sort. So widespread throughout the south and southeast, through into Wales in the 19th century, patchy by the 1960s. By 1990, it confined to a tiny area in South Devon. Through the good offices of RSPB, Wildlife Trust and others, working with farmers, is now expanding out of its Devon heartland, and it's probably quadrupled its range in the last 10 years. The thing that may not strike you about this as being peculiar, but it really ought to, is that we have fine detailed maps going back to the middle of the 19th century. Nowhere else on the planet can we actually map both the distribution of the species, but equally important, the absence of species. The Victorian enthusiasm for collecting natural history also extended to careful, written, published documentation. So parish by parish, county by county, we know where the birds were, where the flowers were, we know where the spiders, the insects, the mussels, the liverworts, and even the lichens were during the 19th century. Nowhere else on the planet has this depth of detailed recording, so that in Britain we can map change in a way that no one else can. And as I say, the really key point is we can be confident about the absences. Elsewhere in the world we may know where things were seen, we don't know where people looked and failed to find. The thoroughness of survey in this country means that the white bits where soil buntings were not present are indeed absences. They're not simply no one has looked. Most people, I think, are familiar and at ease with the concept of species becoming extinct, either in an area or globally. What I want to touch on now is the concept that whole habitats can be eliminated from large geographic areas. Acid peat bogs, dominated by sphagnum bog moss, once covered probably something in the order of 10 or 15% of the English landscape. Most of our lowland areas that were wet would have, rising from those coastal wetlands, domes of acidic peat dominated by plants like these. A whole suite of wildlife lived there. Cambridgeshire, as recently as the 1920s, had large stands of cotton grass. You may still find tiny pockets of this at Wicken Fen, Woodwalden Fen, or Chippenham Fen, but you will not see hundreds of acres turning white with the plumes of bog cotton. You can't see this plant anywhere in Cambridge. It may look a bit sort of scruffy in that picture. Go in close. This is as close as we have to an alien living on the planet. This is sundew, an insect-eating plant. The red blobs attract insects that think it looks like the glistening centre of a flower full of nectar. In fact, it's full of adhesive. The tentacles around the outside edge produce digestive enzymes that dissolve insect flesh, and as you can see, when something lands, the tentacles curl in, hold it into place, dissolve it, digest it, and absorb it. Sundews grow in peat bogs, which are extremely nutrient-poor habitats. They're lacking all the basic nitrates that they can get in the soil over most of the rest of the country. They therefore take to insect eating as a way of getting around it. No longer in Cambridgeshire, or Northamptonshire, or Bedfordshire, or two-thirds of lowland Britain. And one of the most weird and spooky and atmospheric of birds, the nightjar. Related to the swifts and about as peculiar, they arrive in Britain from Africa in late May. They fly back in early September. They are perfectly camouflaged to disappear among bracken and heather. They're almost entirely nocturnal, hence the very large eyes. They feed on moths and they make a noise that's variously described as like a distant motorbike or an old-fashioned sewing machine. A long, eerie, wooden-sounding chirring noise that, if you've never come across it before, totally transforms your impression of heathlands. John Clare wrote about it. Many of the 19th century poets who understood the countryside would recognise this sound. The species is now extinct in Cambridgeshire, Bedfordshire, Northamptonshire, most of central England. Big populations over in Thetford, so if you're really keen to hear something like this, an evening in Breckland on the Norfolk-Suffolk border could be quite an experience. So losing the habitat, we've lost several thousand species that are completely tied to lowland acid peat bog. And it demonstrates for me that we can actually destroy complete habitats over quite large geographic areas. That's actually a peat bog up in Yorkshire where I've done quite a lot of work over the last 30 years. That one was in the process of being destroyed for garden compost. The company's now left and it's now becoming a nature reserve. But I put it in to make the point that in addition to the wildlife, when we destroy a habitat like lowland peatlands, we lose something else as well. Buried within the peat is a wealth of archaeology covering 7,000 or 8,000 years. Most of the post-glacial is preserved. Human activity passes a trackway about 4,500 years old. Within those timbers, there are insects, there's pollen, there are plant macro remains, which can give us a sense of what the environment was like, in this case, just at the end of the Stone Age, the beginning of the Bronze Age. And out of some of the timbers, this is a pine tree about 4,300 years old from radiocarbon dating, and it's a representative of a kind of forest that no longer exists in England and over most of Northern Europe. I can say that with some confidence, because if you dig around in these preserved trees, pickled in the peat of the bog, you find large ants. These are twice the size of the British wood ant. They were living in Yorkshire in the Bronze Age. You now have to travel across to Northern Scandinavia to find these ants which build a nest of pulverised wood, a sort of cardboard carton, inside hollow tree trunks. Other insects preserved in the same sites, this jewel beetle today isn't found north of the Pyrenees. You can find it in the Pyrenean foothills in ancient woodland. And digging through these timbers, we find 40 or 50 insect species completely absent from Britain and northwest Europe these days. Some of them get no further across than the huge ancient forests of Poland. Others are Scandinavian or Mediterranean in the distribution. They all lived together in English pine woods 3,500 years ago. Their disappearance may be partly climatic, but it's certainly in large part due to the absence of extensive, warm, lowland forests in Britain today. And that takes me on to climate change. The climate has changed for a very long time. What we're facing now, and I don't intend to bore you with the basics of climate change, but we're seeing droughts, we're seeing floods at strange times of year, we're seeing storms at odd times of year, and never forget that a summer storm in the lowlands has a much bigger impact on the landscape than normal storms because the broadleaf trees have leaves on them. They have far more resistance, so the big storm of 1987 felled tens of thousands of trees, which would not have been affected had the high winds come 6 weeks later. So if your strange weather events happen at the wrong time of year, they have much bigger impacts. I'm guessing most of you know this already, but a couple of features to draw out from our past climate change. All you need to know is red line, warmest present, blue line, full ice age. In the last million years, we've had something like 8 ice ages with 8 warm periods. Extend back 3 million years and that goes up to about 20 ice ages with short warm periods. Second factor to note is these lines are very nearly horizontal. In other words, we go from full glacial to as warm as present in very nearly no time at all, probably the order of 5 to 20 years. And if you're not convinced by that, look at the history of the beginning of the 14th century. Between 1300 and 1310, we had the onset of a temporary ice age. Thankfully, it didn't persist. But in that decade, there was no summer across Europe for 7 out of 10 years. A third of the human population starved to death. The Danish settlers abandoned Greenland, having, you may have seen some of the documentaries, having had no crops, eaten their livestock, eaten their dogs, eaten their leather, quite probably eaten each other, and they had to abandon it. By 1310 or thereabouts, the Ice Age stopped. We came back to about as warm as present with a few interesting blips in between. But it makes the point that you can see summer temperatures drop by 15 degrees or rise by 15 degrees Celsius in very, very little time. The good news for an ecologist from this is to say that all the wildlife currently living in Cambridgeshire has had to migrate down to somewhere like the Mediterranean 20 times in 3 million years. In other words, all the species that live around us today, we take for granted, have the capability of travelling a couple of thousand miles south, then a couple of thousand miles north again, and repeating this process. My guess is that the very first of the present cycle of ice ages 3 million years ago, there would have been mass extinctions in all of the temperate zones of the world. The one little bit of evidence for this, if you're interested, is if you look at earthworms, the least easy to recolonise of all animal groups. In Britain, we have about 20 species of earthworm. Across most of France, we have about 25 to 30 species. When you get within about 20 miles of the Mediterranean basin, you shoot up to about 200 species of earthworm. And our guess is there's a population there of species which haven't been able to get back because earthworms have no obvious means of long-distance dispersal. They don't fly, they don't often get carried around by anything else, they sit where they are. If that's true, then the odds are that Britain had 200 or 300 species of earthworm 3 million years ago, all but 20 of which were wiped out by the first advancing ice sheet, and very much else as well. Unfortunately, the subsequent ice sheets removed the evidence for what was here 3 million years ago. Anyway, 14,000 years ago, temperature warms up by 15 degrees on average on summer days. Temperature. At this point, Britain is still attached to mainland Europe. The channel didn't appear until about 7,000 years ago, so we had 7,000 years during which all that Mediterranean wildlife could simply walk back into Britain. The recolonisation happened rapidly, and many thousands of species made it. This time around, two strange things are happening. One is climate change is temperature is going up from a warm period. Every previous occasion we've gone from about this temperature down to ice age and back again. We've not, for around 60 million years, seen the temperature rising from a warm period. And secondly, there are barriers in the way. The Channel is the first and biggest barrier, but sitting here in Cambridge, London is a pretty serious barrier to plant and animal dispersal. The motorway network, the rail network, and worst of all, intensive agricultural land, which means that most of the landscape is no longer wildlife habitat. It's a gap between habitats through which species need to move. So this time around, species are going to find it much more difficult to migrate in response to the changing climate. One scrap of good news, and I'll come back to the origins of this in a few minutes, our network of protected sites, sites of special scientific interest and nature reserves, dates back to the 1940s and 50s. In other words, some of these sites were protected just before agricultural intensification started putting chemicals onto the land. So we have, across the country, a network of sites with clean soils, unpolluted by nitrates and phosphates, uncontaminated with agricultural pesticides. So those provide a network of both refugia and stepping stones through which wildlife can hopefully move. Climate change is also going to bring about some fairly drastic changes in the landscape. I've mentioned summer storms fell more trees than normal, regular winter storms. We're already seeing our wetlands drying out. There are ponds and rivers which have run dry for the first time, certainly in recorded human history. We're starting to see heathland fires in southern England, grassland fires already. My guess is that within our lifetimes, most of us will see forest fires back in Britain. This did, oddly enough, happen in the Bronze Age, and there's a debate as to whether or not it was human-induced or if it was simply lightning strikes in hot summers, but the preserved forests under some of those peat bogs suggest something like a 60-year return cycle between major fire episodes. So our wildlife's been exposed to fires before, but what it does do is create more disturbance, more bare ground, and less stable ancient habitats. We think of forests, ancient fens, ancient grasslands has been much the same year on year. Under a changed climate, the life would be much more variable. So moving from habitat and landscape into the species side for a moment, we can make some general predictions as to how wildlife will respond. And as a rule of thumb, if a species currently occurs mainly in the south and east of Britain, it's likely to expand its range and increase in abundance in response to warming. Species which are currently found in the north and west are likely to contract further, move uphill to live in the mountains. The big question mark though is the word if. They can only make these changes in distribution if they are able actually to move through that fragmented, industrially agricultural, developed and built landscape. At the same time, we expect wetland species might have problems, and species tolerant of drought and of disturbance are likely to expand. And just to put a few faces to that concept, what you may have noticed, mountain hares are no longer abundant in Cambridgeshire. They disappeared about 13,000 years ago. If you've never seen a mountain hare and you'd like to, then at present you can see them on the moors above Sheffield in Yorkshire. Within 50 years, they're likely to be extinct in England, so we'd have to go up to Scotland, and within 100 or 150 years, they may have gone from Britain as a whole. You can still see bilberry, the pink flower at the left-hand side, in some of the acid oak woods in Bedfordshire, but like a lot of moorland species, it's thinly scattered in southern and lowland Britain. It's likely to be disappearing in the next 20 to 50 years. And because of their rather bizarre sexual habits, which I'm happy to talk to you in more detail about later, ferns are on the retreat. We've already lost about 15 fern species from Cambridge in the last century. Another 10 or so are likely to disappear in the next century. So that's the bad news. Those are the sorts of things which have a northern and western distribution. Others in this category, which I'm sure you would care about deeply, mosses, liverworts, sedges and crane flies, have more species in the north and west than they do in the south and east. The rest of British wildlife has the opposite trend. We have more species in the south and east than elsewhere. A few recent examples, the Dartford warbler. As a teenage bird watcher, I had to travel down to Surrey or Dorset to see Dartford warblers in the 1970s. These days, they're breeding in Bedfordshire, in Norfolk and Suffolk, as far north even as Cheshire. They've expanded their range by 200 miles in 20 years. The Adonis blue butterfly, the most vivid iridescent blue of any British butterfly, is currently found no further north than the top end of the Chilterns. It's going to move into Bedford in the next 5 or 10 years. It should make the leap onto the Cambridge of chalk, so you'll be able to see it on the chalk hills just to the east of Cambridge, probably within 20 years. The rather magnificent bright green beetle with the cyclist's thighs, the so-called noble flower beetle, used to occur on the South Downs, the North Downs, the Chilterns, the Cotswolds and the East Anglian coast, is now abundant in Cambridge. It arrived about 10 years ago, is now very plentiful. And I think equally charismatic, the Spanish slug arrived in Britain in the early 19th century, was a pest of greenhouses until about 1989, when it was first found living out of doors in Kent. It's now commonplace in Cambridgeshire. If any of you garden and you buy potted plants from garden centres, you have probably also been given free Spanish slugs in the bottom of each potted plant. They're moving around rapidly, they've made it up as far as Scotland and are living out of doors as far north as Yorkshire now. And a few new arrivals that have actually established and are doing remarkably well. Start at the top right, the small white heron there, the little egret, was a rare, mostly winter visitor to Britain. The odd individual would turn up throughout the 20th century. In the mid-1990s, a flock of 200 arrived in the southwest one winter. Rather than flying back to the south of France to breed, they stayed, they bred. We now have many hundreds of pairs nesting in Britain. They breed on the Ouse Washers in Cambridgeshire, the Nene Washers near Peterborough, right along the North Welsh coast. And they appear to be established as a resident permanent part of our fauna. Going round clockwise, the rather exciting beaver with the ginger thorax, black on the abdomen, the white tip to the tail, arrived in Britain in 2000. It's the tree bumblebee, bred in Britain for the first time in 2000. It's now widespread as a breeding species as far north as Yorkshire. If you have deep-cupped flowers in your gardens, you probably have tree bumblebees visiting them. The rather exciting wasp spider, big, colourful, unmistakable, colonised the south coast of Britain in the 1930s. From the 1930s to 1989, it bred only within 10 miles of the coast in Dorset, Sussex and Kent and Hampshire. In 89, it started moving inland. By 95, it had crossed the Thames. By 2000, it was breeding in Bedfordshire. That one was photographed at Camborne, about 8 miles away, where it arrived probably 6 or 7 years ago and is now plentiful. Those three species have something in common. They can fly, they can disperse. You may never have seen a spider flying, but they do. Young spiders, when very small, climb to the tops of the stems of plants, climb onto bushes, stick their bum in the air, throw out a long strand of silk, and wait for warm air to fly past and rise and lift them up. It's called ballooning, and it means that small spiders fly and then basically rain down on the landscape. So wherever you're sitting in short, warm grassland in Cambridgeshire, there could be wasp spider babies raining down on you this springtime. There are at least 50 females, each producing a large egg cocoon with about 200 eggs in it in Camborne last autumn. Those 1,000 individuals are going to be looking for somewhere to fly to. It could be you. And finally, the least likely of all, the rather strange pale green beast up top, is the southern oak bush cricket, closely related to the native English oak bush cricket. In common with that species, it's one of the very few bush crickets that doesn't chirp or sing. Instead, it hangs on the underside of an oak leaf and taps its feet instead. So should you find yourself sitting under an oak tree in autumn and you hear a drumming noise on the leaves, it's likely to be one or other of the oak bush crickets. This one, though, is flightless. And it was a puzzle as to how it got here until someone found one sitting on the underside of the tailgate of a lorry. They come through the channel tunnel and they get dispersed by long-distance lorry drivers. They're now known from 50 or 60 sites in the southeast, not yet in Cambridgeshire, but they should be here within just a couple of years. So our wildlife is already changing rapidly in response to climate change. So all those things together, introduced species, habitat loss and destruction, atmospheric pollution, and climate change, force us to think about protection. To me, rather movingly, in the last 3 or 4 years of the Second World War, some of the greatest brains of post-war conservation were working hard for the survival of the country and planning for the future. Max Nicholson was organising the North Atlantic convoys to provide food for Britain at war. Other conservationists had been fighting in France and across Europe. Some found themselves imprisoned in Colditz and elsewhere. In those days, when the very survival of our culture was at threat, they were planning the land fit for heroes, what comes after. And whereas some top civil servants were thinking about a national health service, social services, education, the welfare state, one bunch of activists were planning nature reserves, national parks, sites of special scientific interest, the Nature Conservancy, a body to research and to manage and to protect the landscape. Many people were so moved by the risk of losing the English countryside as they had known it, aware of what had happened post-Rothschild, many of these were members of the Society for the Promotion of Nature Reserves, they were pushing, and in 1949, the years that saw the health service and the whole of that first Labour government's reforms, one body of reform was to persuade politicians to take the countryside seriously in a way that they had never, ever done before. And we got our national parks, we got access to the countryside, and we got the protected areas. It impresses me that it happened then, because at the moment we had been told we can't do anything for the natural environment during a recession. It's too difficult. My sense is if 1949 was not too difficult, then 2013 should not be too difficult. And during the same period, starting the 30s, a hiatus during the war, and then gathering momentum post-war, the foundation of local organisations to buy land and manage it. What started out as the Naturalists Trusts and now are the Wildlife Trusts, and an interesting shift of emphasis from entertainment for a small, rather geeky class of naturalists to conserving wildlife for the benefit of everyone, and the membership moves up accordingly. The activities of the Naturalists Trusts were essentially identifying small, special places, protecting them. After 20 or 30 years, we decided actually they needed to be managed as well. But still, it wasn't working. The latter half of the 20th century has actually been a process of gradual decline. One of my naturalist mentors described this as writing the rolling obituary of nature. That we survey sites, we document what's there, we resurvey them and document what's disappeared. And gradually, steadily, wildlife retreats, species disappear, sites and the landscape are simplified. So in 2000, just after, the Wildlife Trusts, in common with RSPB and the National Trust, came up with the concept of landscape-scale conservation. Very simple concept, bigger nature reserves, better managed with climate change in mind, and joined up in two senses. Physically connected so that wildlife can move, but also reconnected to people an urbanised population which has very largely turned its back on the countryside and wildlife in the intervening 50 years. The science behind it really came into its own in the 70s and 80s with landscape ecology and a glorious term which I'll allow you to go home and Google, metapopulation dynamics. Basically it says the countryside is patchy, species don't live everywhere. If you're living in a small isolated pocket and you go extinct on that patch of habitat, you're not going to be able to get back unless the countryside is either physically connected or made permeable by stepping stones. And that, in essence, is what we're trying to achieve. Your local wildlife trust has four top priority projects and another eight or so next level down, places where we are buying land, we're advising landowners, we're trying to put back that level of connectivity, and I'll talk you through just a few specific examples. Oh, one in particular, by the way, if you think the West Cambridge 100 sounds a bit archaic and not very sexy, we launched the project at the South Cambridge Forest. And surprise, surprise, farmers did not want to work in a forest. There was total hostility from every landowner in the area to the idea of us creating the South Cambridge Forest. We renamed it, and we now have 26 landowners planting trees at their own expense on their own land. So marketing matters, and just occasionally the sexiest marketing title isn't the one to go for. Ancient woodlands are very nearly unrecreatable. They've taken several thousand years to develop, they're hugely species rich, they're very popular with people, and Cambridge has less of them than any other part of Britain. This is a place where connectivity and rebuilding is most crucial. Here's a cluster of half a dozen ancient woodland sites, and that's better than typical for Cambridge. If you take that picture and assume the white isn't woodland and the green is woodland, that's the sort of place that you're currently living in. Compare that with Sussex, where perhaps 50% of that landscape would be tree covered, and that's what we've lost in this area. And we start out with corridors, we build up to highways, and we finally get greater tree cover across the whole area, and wildlife responds. And it is quite important. Cambridge has about half of Britain's oxlips. They're a strange plant confined to our woodlands and to the woodlands on the inland end of Norfolk and Suffolk and a bit of Essex. Lots of insects. A good ancient woodland will support 5,000, maybe 6,000 species of insect in this country, many of which are not very good at dispersing. Hence, we need connectivity. But Cambridge is probably best known in wildlife circles for its fenland habitats, with these Polish ponies in it to actually maintain some of the open habitats. The flora of the Cambridge Fens is pretty well unique. These three species are all radically declined in Britain. The marsh fragrant orchid is down to maybe 100 sites. Marsh violet in the middle is down to just 3 sites in the whole of the country. And the yellow subspecies of early marsh orchid is down to about 30 individual flowering plants in the country, spread across just 2 sites, one in Cambridge and one in Suffolk. If we don't do something for fens very soon, these plants will have gone for good. And the approach, just to go back to bigger, better and joined up, there are a number of drivers behind the bigger component of landscape conservation. One is that managing at landscape scale is actually cheaper. We can use natural processes, grazing animals, water level movement, and manage large areas much more effectively. The other key point is that if a species has a small population, it's close to extinction. Give it a larger area of habitat, increase the population, it's very simple stuff, it's less likely to go extinct. The Great Fen Project, this is akin to the Wickham Project, which you may be more familiar with. Dark green, 2 national nature reserves, Wood Walton Fen, bought by Rothschild in 1910, Home Fen established by the first Labour government in 49-50, and the pale green area, our vision for the next century. The good news is, from about there northwards, has already been purchased. In the first 10 years, we've acquired half the land of the project area. We've raised £17 million and spent most of it, and we're just one farm short of linking together the two national nature reserves, so that the area of habitat's increased something like threefold so far, and within another 10 years I reckon we'll have probably 5 or 6 times the area of the surviving nature reserves. And just to show how acute the problem is, that is the largest and best surviving bit of open water in the fens. That's intensive farmland, which has put onto it the full range of chemicals I described earlier. And we've got something like a 10-metre strip of trees between nitrates, phosphates, herbicides, fungicides and insecticides, and a unique piece of wildlife habitat of European value. The farm now belongs to the Wildlife Trust. The farmer is farming in a much more gentle way, and within 30 years that will be grassland with grazing cattle and a rising water level. So buffering lands like that to reduce the impacts from outside is crucial. Going back from an intensive arable to a more pastoral landscape, raising the water levels in the ditches and the water level on land, and we're already seeing rare plants turn up in fields which were growing sugar beet 8 years ago and now growing cattle, lapwing, snipe, redshank. And for those who really like the grasses, orange foxtail, a rare Wickham grass, is covering tens of acres of the fens where it was virtually extinct there just 7 or 8 years ago. As to what the future holds, I reckon this is the most exciting time ever to be a naturalist looking at British wildlife, with the possible exception of being here 14,000 years ago when suddenly the temperature rose extremely rapidly. Spoonbills. I've been using this slide for about 7 or 8 years, and for most of that time I've been able to say spoonbills will come back to Britain and breed. They did 2 years ago, so this is now slightly historical. They're not yet in the fens, but it's a sort of exciting exotic species we might hope for. When the Dutch created their first large man-made wetland at Oostvaardersplassen about 20 years ago, within 3 years they had breeding spoonbills. The bird did not breed in the Netherlands until that site was created. Even more remarkable, bluethroat, a small, colourful nightingale, effectively. Bluethroat did not breed in the Netherlands 30 years ago. There are now 600 pairs on that one man-made nature reserve. They've bred in Britain a couple of times in the last decade, so we know they can get over here, create the habitat, and they will find it. This large, rather subtly beautiful dragonfly suffers under the title Norfolk Hawker. That's simply because English names were given to dragonflies a little bit too late. It bred in Cambridgeshire until 1851, when Whittlesea Mere was drained. So it ought really to be the Cambridgeshire Hawker. All of its British sites are within 3 or 4 kilometres of the coast, subject to rising sea levels. It's completely intolerant of saline inundation. One large coastal storm on the east coast could drive that to extinction. There's signs of it moving along the Waveney Valley towards us, and last year a single individual made it to Cambridgeshire and was seen flying around Paxton Pits gravel pits near St Neots for about 3 weeks. So they do just about get here, and if in the Great Fen and at Wickham we create the habitat, there's every likelihood they'll make it back. And this cute little plant is Fen Woodrush. The whole of the UK population would comfortably fit into this room at present. It's an odd plant. It occurs on acid soils in the southern end of Wood Walton Fen and on a bit of Home Fen, typically next to birch trees, as in the picture. Our hope is that we'll move it out from the size of this room to a fair bit of the 9,000 acres of the Fen in the next century. Moving from fens to grasslands, something you may never have thought about. If you see a piece of fairly dry land anywhere in Britain that doesn't have trees growing on it, something is keeping the trees at bay. It's either being grazed, or it's being mown, or something very strange is happening to it. If you leave any plot of land for 20 or 30 years, it's colonised by tall and taller plants, by scrub, then by forest, and it will turn into oak ash woodland probably within 100 years or so. So if it's not got trees on it, it's got something like these guys, prevented that process. It's no longer seen as economic to grow livestock in central and eastern England, so maintaining open habitats is a challenge. The sorts of wildlife we're losing, green-winged orchid, one of dozens of plant species confined to hay meadows and to grazed grasslands. Interesting story here where there's actually a deeper take-home message. The marsh fritillary butterfly in the last century has become extinct in the whole of the eastern half of Britain. There aren't many things you can say that for. It's gone from eastern Scotland, northeast England, East Anglia and the Midlands, and the southeast. The nearest sites for it these days are on Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire. It also occurs in South Wales, Devon, and southwest Scotland. The surprise or the warning is its food plant is Devil's Bit scabious, which is still widespread throughout eastern Britain. However, it doesn't occur in large enough quantities. The butterfly is allied to tortoiseshells and peacock butterflies. They lay their eggs in a batch, their big, fat, hungry caterpillars spin a colonial web, and they live together. 100 hungry caterpillars eat a lot of devil's bit scabious. Unless you've got a big enough population that having killed off one plant, 100 caterpillars can walk and find another healthy large-leaved devil's bit scabious within easy walking distance, they will disappear. Add to that, it's attacked by a parasitic wasp that in peak years can kill off 95% of the caterpillars. So its population already fluctuates, and just thinning out the available food plant means that it very quickly disappears and cannot recolonise. Salisbury Plain is noted for large expanses with lots of large-leaved devil's bit scabious. And that example where the food plant survives but the insects associated with it disappear is pretty typical of extinctions in the last century. This is one of my favourite bits of landscape, and it really demonstrates where we are at the moment and where we need to get to. This is the North Chilterns, just outside Dunstable. So that's Lady Dunstable. Luton would be just through the ceiling. This tiny bit, Tottenham Knowles, has been a wildlife trust reserve for 30 years. In 2000, we built this little zigzag bit. 2 years later, we bought the line works. 2 years ago, we bought this strip. So we've gone from having one reserve to two reserves, then back to one reserve by linking them together. We also manage that strip up there, and we're working with other landowners and developers to join that lot together to move from 20 acres and 25 acres to about 300 acres in a single block. The reason why we need to do it is that wildlife requires bigger, more diverse habitats. This is the little zigzag reserve we bought in 2000, Tottenham Quarry. Three butterflies, typical or representative of the maybe 3,000 or 4,000 species that occupy the reserve. And just talking through the ecology of these, what I want you to do is to look at a landscape through the eyes of a different species. We walk through that site, and as a naturalist, I see it as chalk grassland with some scrub. 50 years ago, it would have been 95% chalk grassland, 5% scrub. It's now 70% scrub, 30% chalk grassland. So I see it as having declined by a substantial proportion. The chalk-hill blue butterfly at the top left breeds only where it's got its food plant, horseshoe vetch, in fairly short turf. So most of the rather lurid green in that picture is chalk-hill blue habitat. The 70% of the site which is scrub covered is a gap between its habitat. Follow the story so far. Next one's the easy one. The small blue butterfly feeds exclusively on kidney vetch growing next to bare chalk. It needs kidney vetch flowers that warm up very quickly, so its caterpillars grow quickly. Therefore, the white bits in the picture are its habitat. So, whereas chalk-hill blue might have 30% of the site as habitat, small blue only has, what, 1% of that picture? So 99% of the picture is gap between habitat, if you're small blue. And finally, if you're a butterfly with a death wish, a Duke of Burgundy at the right-hand side, the story gets even more complicated. Duke of Burgundy feed on cowslip and primrose leaves, growing in grass about that high, fairly close to scrub. So its habitat is a narrow strip zigzagging around the edge there. So it's a strip about 1.5 metres wide, close to the scrub, and the scrub marches forward at a rate which means that strip of habitat survives for maybe 5, maybe 10 years, after which it's too shaded. And if you clear the scrub, the grass is too short and exposed, so that's no good either. And we've been able to quantify that through having a good ecologist on site for 3 years. We know the site has about 4,700 cowslip and primrose plants on it, and in each year, 70 of that 4,700 have butterfly eggs on them. So the vast majority of the habitat, as you or I might see it, is not seen by female Duke of Burgundy as being a suitable place to lay eggs. And indeed, from the time the eggs appear, we know that several of those plants are laid on by two or even three different females, so they must be really attractive plants. When 4,630 plants are ignored completely. That's how specialist a lot of wildlife is. So we look at it as one habitat. Every species sees it as a completely different mosaic, bits of habitat, large areas of non-habitat in between. Now, if you're a butterfly, you may be able to fly from there to there. But that's not necessarily good enough. Oh, I'll come back to gaps and things in a moment. The other thing about chalk grassland is it supports a wide range of orchid species, but not currently these three. Lady orchid does occur in Kent, but not yet in Cambridgeshire and Bedfordshire. Tongue orchid in the middle, didn't occur anywhere in Britain 10 years ago. There are now two species of the tongue orchid, one living in Cornwall, lot one living on the Dorset coast. We believe windblown seeds from Europe provided it. Orchids produce fine dust-like seed that carries in the wind. Chalk soils support many orchid species, including the rather peculiar-looking yellow ophrys. That grows as far north as central France. Central France is within seed windblow distance of the Cambridgeshire chalk. There are probably 50 orchid species in France that don't occur here for which we can create habitats. Habitats may be here already, and given the right winds and the right soils, they will arrive, and the climate is changing rapidly to suit them. So that's a group where we can expect more species in the future than the past. Final part of the story is when it starts to get a bit confusing and potentially rather depressing. What this is saying is that the past is no longer a particularly good guide to the future. Experience of land management over the last 50 years or 500 years doesn't tell us what we need to do next year. And for the gardeners among you, this is really obvious in one way. For instance, if you have a lawn, you may remember a time when there was a closed season for mowing the lawn. It used to be that you stopped mowing the lawn in September or October and didn't have to start again until April. And then it was sort of late October to March, and this year it's probably going to be February that you start mowing again, right through until November. The time may come when there isn't a closed season for lawn mowing. That means we need more sheep and cattle to do the same amount of grazing because the plants are growing for longer and more vigorously. And we basically need to monitor our effectiveness to get it right. This is Devil's Dyke, just outside Cambridge City. It's one of five Saxon earthworks. Very good of them, actually. Those of you who know anything about experimental design will recognise that putting in five replicates of the same habitat on an east-west line, so that you've got a sunny south-facing slope and a shady north-facing slope on each of the five, was really well thought out. So if you want to see what 1,400 years of Cambridgeshire climate does to the north or south side of a slope of chalk grassland, the Saxons have provided it for us. Much of it is rather beautiful. It's a great place to see wild orchids, it's a great place to see other flowers. And if you're really keen, it's a fantastic place to see heath snails. This lovely little animal has disappeared from about 90% of its British sites over the last 50 years. And having studied it for the last 20 years on Devil's Dyke, I have a clearer idea of why. In hot, sunny years, heath snails only breed on the north slope of Devil's Dyke. In cold, wet years, they only breed on the sunny south-facing slope. As luck would have it, I can't go back, so I'll have to describe it. On Devil's Dyke, the distance from north to south is about one night's snail crawl. Therefore, they have survived. On many well-managed nature reserves throughout southern Britain, where you have large, flat fields of chalk, be they north-facing or south-facing, the species has disappeared. Not because the land manager got it wrong, but because the lack of topographic variation has prevented the species coping with weather conditions. I mentioned chalkhill blue earlier and its food plant. Chalkhill blue, thank you. Chalkhill blue, like many blue butterflies, has a caterpillar that secretes sugar, and ants like sugar. This chalkhill blue caterpillar has been protected by a sort of covering of red ants, which will defend it from potential predators. This butterfly takes it a stage further and really harnesses the ant's addiction to sugar. The large blue lays her egg on the flowers of wild thyme. Small caterpillar feeds on wild thyme flowers for about 5 days. Within that 5-day period, a particular species of red ant will find the caterpillar, pick it up, and take it underground into the ant nest. Inside the ant nest, it transforms from being a gentle plant feeder to being an avid predator on the larvae and pupae of the ants. The caterpillar secretes sugar solution, the ants like the sugar, and it is an addiction. The ants are so fond of sugar, they are happy to allow this pest into the nest and feed on their babies. It's so serious that if the ants take more than two caterpillars into the nest, three or more larvae will eliminate the next generation and the ant nest will collapse. That's quite a remarkable bit of ecology. The most puzzling part of it, this species became extinct in Britain in the 1970s, just at the time we worked out its ecology in detail. The puzzle, though, is that the surviving sites throughout the 20th century were all sunny, south-facing limestone and chalk soils. So the Mendips, the Cotswolds, the Chilterns were large blue butterfly habitat with lots of red ants on the sunny, south-facing slopes. In the 19th century, if butterfly collectors are to be believed, the best place in Britain to find large blues was a site called Barnwell Wold in Northamptonshire, a flat, cold clay meadow next to the river. We never understood how this could be. The story was, they made it up. They put the wrong labels on in order to put people off the scent, so they go looking for butterflies in the wrong place. Not so. The answer was a different species of ant. Yellow meadow ant produces the big anthills that you've probably seen in Cambridgeshire. What you may not have thought on is an anthill has a sunny south-facing slope and a shady north-facing slope. The mound is made by 10,000 workers of little yellow ant, but stick a teaspoon in the top, you'll find the yellow ant, stick it in the sunny south-facing side, and about one hill in three will have red ants living on it. And we believe that at Barnwell, there are enough anthills to give enough sunny south-facing slopes to have the red ant. On top of the anthills, we'd have the wild thyme flowers, and so one ant species transformed the landscape to create spaces for a different ant species, to create space for a different butterfly species. The important thing is that is enough topography to give you a sunny south-facing slope. So when we diversify our reserve management, we don't actually need to go quite that far. The end is in sight, by the way. So the joined up bit is physically connecting sites, is making the countryside easier for wildlife to move through, and it's reconnecting with people. Rare photo, the A14 with traffic moving. Along its banks, there's some pretty good habitat, but it's intermittent, it's not consistent. It doesn't provide you with that woodland, grassland corridor. I used to always to talk about wildlife corridors, but then it occurred to me, corridors sound rather sort of narrow and bureaucratic. Wildlife highways give you a greater sense of the dynamism of it, and this picture captures what I think a wildlife highway should have in it. It's got open water, it's got squidgy bits, it's got grassland, and it's got woodland. Most wildlife can move along that. Something you may never have thought about, if I said we'd got two woodland nature reserves and we wanted to join them together by planting trees, that would probably make sense. So two woods joined by a corridor of woodland so that species can move between them. What people seldom think about is that that shelter belt or big hedgerow between two woods can actually be a barrier for insect and plant movement from the two meadows on either side of it. Go back to the small blue butterfly living on those patches of white chalk among the scrub. Not many small blues fly over the scrub to look for more habitat. They tend to fly within their hatch. So a shelter belt that links together two woods can be a barrier that separates two meadows, and an awful lot of species will not disperse across that barrier. A corridor or highway looking like that is a place within which the full range of wildlife species can move and, if necessary, can live short term. But it all boils down to getting people involved as well. It's people and our overpopulation, which have simplified the English landscape, fragmented wildlife habitat, and made it difficult for wildlife to move through it. And it's people who are going to make the difference. Now, this computer artist's impression of the Great Fen in 50 or 100 years' time, with something like Whittlesea Mere recreated, lots of reed bed and wet grassland, and lots of wet woodland, is pretty good. 9,000 acres, a great place to spend a few days' holiday. However, the arrows signify something worse. In 50 to 100 years' time, Cambridge's wildlife, or some of it, may need to live as far north as Lancashire or Cheshire. The species for which the Great Fen will be ideal in half a century may currently be living in Kent or in northern France. That points to the need for this to be a national vision. If the London Wildlife Trust doesn't get its act together, then much of our future wildlife will be trapped in Kent and unable to move through London to reach us here. And as I've touched on, we need to get it right for people. If you've never been out to Camborne, by the way, I can recommend it. Camborne is a new settlement, 5,000 houses, 60% of the envelope of the development is still green space. It's better for wildlife now than it was when it was fields of oilseed rape and winter wheat. And it's a place where you will see children walking to school through the woods, families cycling around the meadows and the lakes to get to the supermarket. Green space used by people and good for wildlife. The government's recognising, I think, that both physical and mental health are enhanced by access to the countryside and the activity that goes with it. Quite remarkably, Professor Sir John Lawton, one of our foremost ecologists, was commissioned by Gordon Brown's government to review the state of our wildlife habitats. His report was called Making Space for Nature. The remarkable thing is that having been commissioned by the last government, it's being implemented by the present. Caroline Spelman, Secretary of State, introduced a white paper in the Natural Environment last year, which basically went through what Lawton was saying, which in summary was bigger, better, joined up. We need more wildlife habitat in larger patches, connected through the countryside, and better managed with climate change in mind. And finally, I rather like this picture because it's by a Russian artist coming to Cambridgeshire and predicting what our future ought to be. This is his vision of the Great Fen. That straight line is the East Coast Main Railway line, so if you go ever from London to Peterborough by train, you go along. It takes you 6 minutes to go alongside the Great Fen, and when you get stuck outside Peterborough next to the Birch Woods, that's Home Fen National Nature Reserve. The lovely thing about this story, though, is it was painted as part of something called the Artists for Nature Foundation. For the previous 20 years, world-renowned wildlife artists had travelled around the planet painting wildlife in South America, in Africa, in India, painting what's there and trying to protect it. This was the first time they'd come to Britain, and they came to paint wildlife that wasn't there yet. And they painted what was there in the fens, but Vadim Gorbatov also gave us this view of what I like to think of as Northamptonshire trains flying out of the Nen Valley, stopping off in the Great Fen on the way to several new man-made wildlife habitats in East Anglia. And by the end of this century, we could be there. And a final thought to leave you on a positive and optimistic note. Since the end of the Stone Age, if not slightly earlier, the English landscape has been degraded and simplified from a wildlife point of view. People have expanded. By the time the Romans arrived, most of our woodland cover had already gone. The pattern of woodland in Cambridgeshire hadn't changed hugely in 2,000 years. But what has changed is the land in between. So gradually, 4,000, 4,500 years of degradation, simplification, fragmentation and reduction. I think by 2100, we will look back. Someone will look back and say that sometime between 1990 and 2020, we turned a corner. I can't tell you whether it's happened yet, but I'm confident that within the next 5 or 10 years, we'll have got to the stage where we are restoring more habitat in lowland England than we are destroying. Not quite as positive as it sounds in that we've basically trashed it so much there's not a great deal left to destroy, but I think actually, for the first time in human history, we're taking responsibility for the species we share our country with, and we're starting to actually reverse that process. On which positive note, I will say thank you. I think we need both. My worry with every environment is, like most agricultural things, it's temporary. We don't yet know whether or not single farm payment is going to carry on after 2014. So the CAP review, the review of European agricultural policy in 2 years' time, could remove much of the stewardship that we've been putting a lot of emphasis on. The thing that actually drives my hope in this arena is actually surprising enough, peak oil. That we've reached a state where fuel prices and agrochemical prices are getting so high that a farm can have a more effective economy by farming slightly less land. There's marginal land on almost every farm, which is getting to the point where it costs more in fuel and input costs than it produces in food. And at that point, farmers will find it economic to omit those tiny bits from their cropping regimes. The hope is that we can use government incentives to make those omitted areas from cropping join up. The easiest would be to say the outside of every farm is the bit you should omit, because if every farm leaves a 10-metre strip around the outside, those outside bits join up to give you a national network. The danger otherwise is, as happened in the 80s under set-aside, when 5 or 10% of all the cropland came out of production, it was random bits, and it didn't actually join up either for wildlife or for people's access to green space. But as I say, my feeling is that if it's funded by government, the funding will dry up. But if it's done through sensible environmental economics, farming economics, then we may have something that will last.
Conservation is obviously about choices fundamentally. I wonder how your organisation makes choices about where to prioritise, what kind of species to or ecosystems that you want to invest in. You showed some examples of the things that you've been doing. I wonder how you're reacting to government targets or members.
I hope The priorities we set in our first development plan in about 1998-99. I took over as conservation director about that time, and we started thinking more strategically. Basically, we audited what there was out there and what our three candidates were special for. And perhaps not surprisingly, it was very strongly driven by soil and geology. So the chalk, the greensands, the boulder clay woodlands and the fens are the habitats for which our three counties are best known. They're the places with the most specialised species and the rarer species and more vulnerable species. So those are the places to start. And if push comes to shove and you've got to focus even further, then I would say fens come as number one, chalk grassland probably as number two, ancient woodland number three, and wetlands outside of the fen as number four, simply in terms of what's there. And our starting point was protect what you've got, then enhance it, then recreate stuff elsewhere. So it's a fairly simple sort of triage process.
I'm just interested to hear what you say about the whole landscape approach in terms of, you talked about joining things together. I guess the first reaction I had was how big and like what's the scale that we're talking about? How big is enough or essential? And then the second thing is you talked about process, attacking processes. How do you define what are the basic processes that you're looking at? Is that hydrology process or?
It's basically everything that sustains life. So to start with your first question, the answer varies depending on the species and the habitat. So you can conserve chalk butterflies on 40 or 50 acres of land. It's a quite small piece of land, can sustain butterfly populations. Preferably they want to be in different stages of grazing and development. They want to be fragmented but linked together. Bizarrely, fragmentation is actually a good thing at a certain level. The gist of metapopulations is to say that a single, completely connected, uniform population will fluctuate up and down together. If you divide it into four or five separate habitat patches, then they're likely to go out of synchrony, which means the species is more likely to survive. So, oddly enough, the fact that a natural landscape is heterogeneous and species are not actually uniformly spread is good news for biology. It allows species to fluctuate independently and to have this colonization extinction process. So some species need very large areas. Some big birds of prey might need tens of square miles. Cranes won't nest closer than about 3 kilometres between nests as a rule. So unless you've got your wetlands over quite a large area, you will not build a sustainable population. Most of Europe's cranes nest in around the Arctic Circle in Scandinavia and Siberia, where you do have those massive expanses of wetlands. And pairs will be probably within calling distance of each other. They make a hell of a racket. And that call probably travels 1 or 2 miles, and that's probably about the distance between nest sites in most habitats. So that's one extreme. Butterflies and beetles are the other extreme. So the right patch size for each habitat, or the acceptable minimum patch size for each habitat, depends both on habitat and on species. In terms of process, it's whatever would normally have happened at a landscape scale over the 3 or 4 million years that these species have been around. So hydrology is very important. Raising water levels and reconnecting floodplains with the river is actually good practice for people because it stops our towns and cities getting flooded. It also rejuvenates the wildlife and the habitats of the floodplains themselves. It's been argued actually by Oliver Acken, a Cambridge academic, that the one thing that's lacking in English woodlands at present is elephants. That this is one of the few interglacials which has not had a mammal like an elephant in Northern Europe. They survived on some of the Mediterranean islands, I think, until about 20, 30,000 years ago. And they were the only mammal able to fell trees apart from people. As elephants are not providing that tree felling, that creating of clearings, that dynamism in woodland management, we have to do it ourselves. So one reason why traditional medieval forest crafts like coppicing and pollarding are good for wildlife, they're sort of mimicking what elephants would have done. So in woodlands we need that sort of practice. In grasslands we need steady grazing with occasional catastrophic effects. I'm a great believer that rare events are important for wildlife. So very hot summers allow immobile species to travel long distances. So our rarest butterfly, the black hair streak, most years, it feeds on a plant called blackthorn. And most years, if I'm one blackthorn bush and you at the back of the room are another black thornbush, were too far apart for most black airstrips to travel. In very hot summers, they've been observed flying 300, 400, 500 metres. But that may only happen once in 20 or 30 years. Most of our ecology comes from PhD students, and a three-year PhD usually misses the rare events when strange things happen. So we need a landscape within which rare events happen often enough to provide the interest. Again, if you look at tree structure in woodland, very often you'll find that the growth of beech trees or oak trees happens maybe once every 60 years. Something happens that means that maybe 2 years running there's a surplus of oak and acorn production, mass of the small mammals, then you have 2 or 3 years with none at all the small mammal populations die, and you're left with very few mammals to eat acorns, then the trees have a good year, and suddenly for that 1 year, acorns are produced and grow. So rare events need both large scale and the scope for everything from storms, fires, floods, grazing animals, and ideally, heads of grazing animals moving at their own accord, so certain areas get hammered by grazing, while others are hardly touched for a period.
I've got a question about, it's quite a fantastical question. Your point about it being joined up, it makes complete sense. But I was just wondering about Roderick Nash's idea of how places of wilderness can become more prominent in the landscape, and he talks about how ideally humans should live in very densely populated urban centres, and everything around is the natural landscape. And I'm just, is that ever possible?
I think it's possible with fairly small human populations. I doubt it's possible with 60 million, 70 million, 80 million people in Britain, if we want to be anything approaching self-sufficient. But at the moment we're about, 45-50% producing our own food. International trade does the rest of it, and that's probably a good thing. If the human population carries on growing beyond 7, 8, 9 billion, then very little of the planet, I suspect, will be wilderness in that sense. But that begs the question of whether we've got a planet that's enough to support the numbers of people and the sort of lifestyle that certainly the West probably aspires to. And frankly, I think we don't. And in medieval period, if Britain was supporting 5 million people, we could do that on maybe 10 or 15% of the lowlands and the rest of it. The reason we've got ancient woodlands on our hilltops around here, but you might be familiar with having hills, but if you look around, the tops of hills tend to be covered in trees because of its heavier clay soils, the old clay from the last ice age, which is hard to cultivate. The fact that it hadn't been cultivated by 1950 has meant it's tended to survive because landowners quite like having woods to shoot pheasants from. Had we had a population of 20 million in the medieval period, my guess is we'd have lost woodland except where it was extremely valuable for building or for other purposes. So I think with 60 million people, it's hard to imagine a lot of large areas of wilderness. But my sort of thinking a century ahead, I suppose my image is a network of very large, complex, diverse sites between which there are lots of small sites. The happiest statistic of my wildlife trust, discovered about 5 years ago, 95% of our local population live within 5 miles of one of our nature reserves. Now the average nature reserve is only 30 acres, about 10 hectares, so it's tiny, but it's close to people. So here within Cambridge City you've probably got, 7 or 8 of our sites and lots of the city council sites as well. So everybody can walk or cycle to somewhere rather good. And although they're not wildernesses, they can have a wilderness element at least at some times of year and sometimes a day. Walk on Devil's Dyke at dawn and it feels much as it did when the Saxons built it. No traffic noise, not so much aircraft noise, no signs of people, and it's a pretty impressive experience.
Just to follow on from your answer on from the question, I'm kind of interested to know what you think wilderness is.
The honest answer is I've not thought a great deal about it. I suppose it's the place where you didn't constrain process or species. So it's a place where if there's a big fire, it carries on. If there are large herds of grazing animals that are going to eat out one area and starve to death, you let them. And oddly enough, that's actually on a different problem we're likely to get into.
animal welfare standards in Britain are such that we can't use sheep or cattle to do the sort of grazing that some sites might need. Ironically, for wild animals, it's okay to let them starve, but you can't allow domestic stock to starve in Britain at the moment. And the Dutch have discovered that even allowing them to be killed by each other and leave the corpse there to rot isn't very acceptable to English tourists. The Dutch and the Germans cope, the English are rather sensitive to rotting corpses of cattle. So yeah, to me, wilderness would be a place where natural processes carry on unhindered. They tend to be on a large enough scale that you can actually allow that to happen. And on most narrow nature reserves, if a large fire starts, we put it out. Because the species didn't evolve to have 100% of the habitat burnt. And on a 30-acre heathland, it's very easy for that to happen. And they, again, grazing animals, flood, storm, would have their impact and would not be tidied up after. My impression is that in terms of the physical management, at least, the Americans have got it right in some of their national parks. They're big enough that most of those processes go on pretty well uninterrupted. Where they do have difficulty is large numbers of visitors and managing access and managing big mammal populations in order to satisfy the visitor pressure. And again, it comes down to too many people.
I'm sort of interested in where the impulse towards conservation might somehow clash with the impulse to stop extinction. And for example, the American mink that you're mentioning is obviously an interloper that may that you may desire to eradicate from an area, and possibly a similar example, but from a different point of view, you might wish to eradicate mosquitoes from a certain area for other reasons. If that was ever the case, would there be some sort of protocol where you would try and preserve the thing you are otherwise deliberately removing, like the smallpox virus?
I was going to get around to that. Yes.
Or would there be a, you can't do it because of that, you can't ever totally eradicate something?
I mean, I could answer that question with another question, which is what's conservation for? And I think there's actually the two obvious extremes here. There are those who believe conservation is actually our duty to the natural environment. We share a planet with 20 or 30 million species. We ought to make sure we continue to do so. And there are those who say, purely utilitarianly, we conserve for people. People like wildlife, therefore we conserve it. If people stop liking wildlife, we stop conserving it. I'm closer to the first position than the second. I don't particularly want to share my country with smallpox. If you're being strictly purist, we are probably within a generation of being able to rebuild smallpox from the genetic code, so that you could actually recreate smallpox without actually having to have it sitting around. So if you've got a passion for the existence of viruses, you could keep them as a library rather than as a sample.
Yeah.
We can't currently do that for larger organisms, and I'm quite pleased we can't. I'd rather keep orangutans where they are than having the technology to rebuild one should we want one in a millennium's time. On the conservation side, where we do occasionally get into interesting situations are where pest species in our area are globally endangered. Chinese water deer is common in the Cambridge Fens. We have something like a sixth of the world's population of Chinese water deer in Britain. They're declining in China and increasing in Britain. There are at least half a dozen species of African rainforest snails living in Kew Gardens in the Palm House that were indigenous to rainforests in Africa that no longer exist. So every time the botanist at Kew tries killing his snail pests, he may be pushing the snail for global extinction. They've got the message now, they're a little bit more generous in their tolerance of the mollusk pests. But it's an interesting thought that there are things that we regard as pests that others would regard as conservation priorities.
Probably just to sort of share a perspective on that, I was in New Zealand recently where the Department of Conservation spends most of its time and energy on eradicating small mammals. For the reasons that David has started the lecture about how they're invasive and they're decimating ground nesting birds, that kind of thing. But it is amazing going there from with a sort of British perspective on conservation and seeing that they're talking very proudly about a new device for efficiently killing stoats, developing poisons and all this kind of thing. It's incredible. But that's conservation in their context. It's basically about killing.
And so, talking New Zealand, there's a flip side to a story like that. In the 1930s, the New Zealanders were trying to grow clover fields and they didn't have the right pollinating insects. They introduced a British bumblebee called Bombus subterraneus, which is thriving in New Zealand. It became extinct in Britain about 10 years ago. It's now being introduced, so we've actually got British Bombus subterraneus stocks to bring back to Britain from New Zealand. The New Zealanders haven't carefully looked after them for the intervening 60 or 70 years. So, yeah, looking at it globally, you do hit some very strange... The other point I would make is we prioritise in Britain a lot of species that are extremely common in mainland Europe. And there's an argument to say, well, why bother? A lot of our rare bird species, and all the fuss over reintroducing sea eagles to the East Anglian coast, they're pretty abundant over a lot of West Europe. They're starting to winter on the Dutch coast, they'll colonise naturally. And again, dare I mention it, osprey, one of the real sort of emblematic species of the conservation movement, is the world's commonest medium-sized bird of prey. It breeds on every continent apart from Antarctica. You can see it in urban wetlands across most continents. It happens to disappear from bits of Britain and Northern Europe, and we made a big song and dance and spent hundreds of thousands of pounds re-establishing it. But it's still the world's commonest medium-sized bird of prey. Currently, there are about the Wildlife Trust have 120. The RSPB have about 40 FutureScapes. The National Trust have about 10 landscape-scale projects. National Trust is a slightly odd one in that, in addition to a place like Wickham, it manages a larger proportion of the coastline than anybody else. So they may not have many sites, but if Cornwall's coast is one site, they're doing a very good job. So across the organisations, you could probably say around 200-220. You'll hear in the news today, by the way, that the government has just announced 12 nature improvement areas out of the Environment White Paper from last year. This, I have to say, this is the government getting on the back of what everybody's been doing already. It reminds me, actually, of not very good puppy trainers. Somebody who's not good at training puppies will wait to see what a puppy's about to do and then tell it to do it. You watch the dog, it's about to sit down, you say sit, and people are really impressed. The government's doing this with conservation. They've launched, as a brand new idea, landscape-scale conservation. Massive funding, £7.5 million for 12 nature improvement areas to answer the question across the country. And we're all being terribly polite outside of this room. I'm sorry, I'm possibly being a bit more direct than usual. So nationally, the government is putting in £7.5 million. In the Great Fen, we put in £17 million in the last decade. I think that gives you a sense of scale. But as pump priming, as a way of generating profile and publicity, getting local councils bought into it, and the Nen Valley in Northamptonshire is one of the successful dozen, so we're cheering today. That's £600,000 coming to help us with the vision that we've been pursuing for the last few years. The key point, I think, about nature improvement areas, though, isn't the numbers, it's the fact that the government sees them as proving that landscape-scale conservation fits with development and human well-being. And if we can get that message across, that this isn't obstructing development, it's actually making places where companies want to relocate. One of my happiest days at Camborne was showing around a group of councillors from Corby in North Hants, fairly depressed area, high unemployment. The councillors saw Camborne and said, we want one too. The way one of them actually expressed it was quite scary. What he said was, what we need in Corby is more unaffordable housing. And we knew what he meant. It's actually, how do you raise the tone of a place? And the answer is more green space. Where do people want to live? Generally not in the sorts of places they can afford to at the moment.
You mentioned London being the London's wildlife trust they have to figure out what to do next. But what are the options there? It just
the main one is actually sorting out the river valleys. And oddly enough, the Olympics may do quite a lot for us in this. The Lee Valley, where quite a lot of Olympic activity is happening, should be greener at the end of the Olympics than it was before. And river corridors obviously provide that network. And the nice thing for London is that although the Thames runs east-west, most of its tributaries run north-south, and so provide that link from Kent to the Thames and then out into Essex or Hertfordshire. So river corridors are one option, making the most of green spaces is another, and we're not quite sure what its long-term impact is, but actually wildlife gardening and getting ordinary people to actually make their gardens more flower-rich, more structurally diverse, and less dosed with chemicals could actually make a big difference. From a bird point of view, gardens are essentially open woodland. If you look at the birds we see in our garden in this country, robins are shy, secretive woodland birds in mainland Europe. In Britain, because of the British attitude to garden birds, robins are somehow closer and friendlier than they are anywhere else on the planet. But blue tits, great tits, coal tits are hole nesting birds that should nest in rot holes in ancient trees in forests. So our gardens are effectively open woodland. And if we don't have enough rotten trees with holes in them, we put up little boxes with holes in that do the same job. So it's working for the birds, slight adjustments to the way we garden, and it actually becomes a pretty good linked set of corridors. And again, if you look down at aerial photos of most cities, certainly the outer suburbs, the bigger gardens, are really very well linked together. A bit lacking in open water, so we need more garden ponds. And forget the mosquitoes.